No doubt Emperor Jigang had spread their description far and wide and had offered a reward large enough that even his enemies would find it hard to resist. For many in the old world, though, the price of continued life under the brutal rule of the Imperial Order was too high. Despite the reward, there were many who hungered to live free and were willing to act to gain that goal. There was also a problem of the bond the Lord Rawl had with the Daharan people. Through that ancient bond forged by Richard's ancestors, Daharans could sense where the Lord Rawl was. The Imperial Order could discover where Richard was by that bond, too. All they had to do was torture the information out of a Daharan. If one person failed to talk under torture, they would not be shy about trying others until they learned what they wanted. As Richard watched, the lone man, once he reached the bottom of the hill, made his way along the gravel beds lining the bottom of the rocky gullies. Off to Richard's right, the wagon and horses were lifting a long trail of dust. That was where the man seemed to be headed. At such a distance, it was hard to tell for sure, but Richard doubted that the man was a soldier. He wouldn't likely be a scout, not in his own homeland, and they weren't near the hotbeds of the revolt against the rule of the Imperial Order. Richard didn't think there would be any reason for soldiers to be going this way, through such uninhabited areas. That was, after all, why he had picked this route, heading east to the shadow of the mountains, before turning to a more northerly route, back to where they had been. There was also the possibility that the bond had inadvertently revealed Richard's whereabouts and an army was out looking for him. If the man was a soldier, there could shortly be many more, like ants, swarming down out of the hills. Richard climbed the back side of a short rocky prominence and lay on his stomach, watching over the top. As the man got closer, Richard could see that he looked young, under 30 years, a bit scrawny, and was dressed nothing at all like a soldier. By the way he stumbled, he was not used to the terrain, or maybe just not used to traveling. It was tiring walking over ground of loose, sharp, broken rock, especially if it was on a slope, since it never provided any solid place for a steady stride. The man stopped, stretching his neck to peer at the wagon. Panting from the effort of making it down the slope, he combed his fine, blonde hair back repeatedly with his fingers, then bent at the waist and rested a hand on a knee while he caught his breath. When the man straightened and started out once more, crunching through the gravel at the bottom of the wash, Richard slid back down the rock. He used the intervening lay of the land and patches of scraggly pine to screen himself from sight. He paused from time to time as he moved closer to listen for the heavy footsteps and labored breathing, checking his dead-reckoning estimation of where the man would be. From behind a freestanding wall of rock a good 60 feet tall, Richard carefully peered out for a look. He had managed to close most of the distance without the man being aware of his presence. Richard moved silently from tree to rock to the backside of slopes until he was out ahead of the man and in his line of travel. Still as stone behind a twisted reddish spire of rock jutting from the broken ground, Richard listened to the crunch of footfalls approaching, listened to the man gulping for breath as he climbed over fingers of rock that lay in his way. When the man was not 6 feet away, Richard stepped out right in front of him. The man gasped, clutching his light travel coat beneath his chin as he cringed back a step. Richard regarded the man without outward emotion. But inside, the sword's power churned with the menace of rage restrained. For an instant, Richard felt the power falter. The magic of the sword keyed off its master's perception of danger. So such hesitation could be because the smaller man didn't appear to be an immediate threat. The man's clothes, brown trousers, flaxen shirt, and a light frayed fustian coat, had seen better days. He looked to have had a rough time of his journey, but then Richard, too, had put on unassuming clothes in order not to raise suspicion. The man's backpack looked to hold precious little. Two water skins, their straps crisscrossed across his chest, bunching the light coat, were flat and empty. He carried no weapons that Richard saw, not even a knife. The man waited expectantly, as if he feared to be the first to speak. "You appear to be headed for my friends," Richard said, tipping his head toward the thin golden plume of dust hanging like a beacon in the sunlight above the darkening plain, giving the man a chance to explain himself. The man, wide-eyed, shoulders hunched, raked back his hair several times. Richard stood before him like a stone pillar blocking his way. The man's blue eyes turned to each side, apparently checking to see if he had an escape route, should he decide to bolt. "I mean you no harm," Richard said. "I just want to know what you're up to." "Up to? Why you're headed for the wagon." The man glanced toward the wagon, not visible beyond the craggy folds of rock, then down at Richard's sword and finally up into his eyes. "I'm looking for help," he finally said.
"Help?"
The man nodded. "Yes, I'm searching for the one whose craft is fighting." Richard cocked his head. "You're looking for a soldier of some kind?" He swallowed at the frown on Richard's face. "Yes, that's right." Richard shrugged. "The Imperial Order has lots of soldiers. I'm sure that if you keep looking, you will come across some." The man shook his head. "No, I seek the man from far away, from far to the north. The man who came to bring freedom to many of the oppressed people of the old world. The man who gives us all hope that the Imperial Order, may the Creator forgive their misguided ways, will be cast out of our lives so that we can be at peace once again."
"Sorry," Richard said. "I don't know anyone like that."
The man didn't look disappointed by Richard's words. He looked more like he simply didn't believe them. His fine features were pleasant-looking, even though he appeared unconvinced.
"Do you think you could..." The man hesitantly lifted an arm out, pointing. "At least, let me have a drink?"
Richard relaxed a bit. "Sure." He pulled the strap off his shoulder and tossed his water skin to the man. He caught it as if it were a precious glass he feared to drop. He pried at the stopper, finally getting it free, and started gulping the water. He stopped abruptly, lowering the water skin.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to start drinking all your water right down."
"It's all right," Richard gestured for him to drink up. "I have more back at the wagon. You look to need it." As Richard hooked a thumb behind his wide leather belt, the man bowed his head in thanks before tipping the water skin up for a long drink.
"Where did you hear about this man who fights for freedom?" Richard asked.
The man brought the water skin down again, his eyes never leaving Richard as he paused to catch his breath.
"From many a tongue. The freedom he has spread down here in the old world has brought hope to us all."
Richard smiled inwardly at how the bright hope of freedom burned even in a dark place like the heart of the old world. There were people everywhere who hungered for the same things in life, for a chance to live their life free and by their own labor to better themselves. Overhead, a black-tipped race, wings spread wide, popped into sight as it glided across the open swath of sky above the rise of rock to each side. Richard didn't have his bow, but the race stayed out of range anyway. The man shrank at seeing the race the way a rabbit would shrink when it saw a hawk.
"Sorry, I can't help you," Richard said when the race had disappeared.
He checked behind in the direction of the wagon out beyond the nearby hill.
"I'm traveling with my wife and family looking for work, for a place to mind our own business."
Richard's business was the revolution. If he was to have a chance for his plan to work, and there were a number of people waiting on him in that regard. He had more urgent problems first, though.
"But, Lord Rawl, my people need..."
Richard spun back around.
"Why would you call me that?"
I'm sorry,"
the man swallowed.
"I didn't mean to anger you."
"What makes you think I'm this Lord Rawl?"
The man painted his hand up and down in front of Richard as he sputtered, trying to find words.
You just are. I can't imagine. What else would you want me to say? I'm sorry if I have offended you by being so forward, Lord Rawl."
Kara stalked out from behind a rocky spire.
"What have we here?"
The man gasped in surprise at seeing her as he flinched back yet another step, clutching the water skin to his chest as if it were a shield of steel. Tom, his silver knife to hand, stepped up out of a gully behind the man, blocking the way should the man decide to run back the way he'd come. The man turned in a circle to see Tom towering behind. As he finally came back around and saw Kalin standing beside Richard, he let out another gasp. They all were wearing dusty traveling clothes, but somehow Richard didn't suppose that at that moment they looked at all like simple travelers in search of work.
"Please," the man said. "I don't mean any harm."
"Take it easy," Richard said as he stole a sidelong glance at Kara.
His words meant not only for the man, but for the moored Sith as well.
"Are you alone?" Richard asked him.
Yes, Lord Rawl, I'm on a mission for my people, just as I told you. You are, of course, to be forgiven your aggressive nature. I would expect nothing less. I want you to know I hold no feelings of resentment toward you. Why does he think you're the Lord Rawl? Kara said to Richard in a tone that sounded more accusation than question. I've heard the descriptions, the man put in. Still clutching the waterskin to his chest, he pointed with the other hand. And that sword! I've heard about Lord Rawl's sword. His gaze moved cautiously to Kaelin. And the Mother Confessor, of course, he added, dipping his head.
Of course, Richard sighed.
He'd expected that he would have to hide the sword around strangers, but now he knew just how important that was going to be whenever they went into any populated areas. The sword would be relatively easy to hide. Not so with Kaelin. He thought that maybe they could cover her in rags and say she was a leper. The man leaned cautiously out, arm extended, and handed Richard his waterskin. Thank you, Lord Rawl. Richard took a long drink of the terrible-tasting water before offering it to Kaelin. She lifted hers out for him to see as she declined with a single shake of her head. Richard took another long swig before replacing the stopper and slinging the strap back over his shoulder.
What's your name? He asked.
Owen.
Well, Owen, why don't you come back to camp with us for the night? We can fill up your waterskins for you at least before you're on your way in the morning.
Kara was near to bursting as she gritted her teeth at Richard. Why don't you just let me see to...
I think Owen has problems we can all understand. He's concerned for his friends and family. In the morning, he can be on his way, and we can be on ours.
Richard didn't want the man out there somewhere in the dark where they couldn't as easily keep an eye on him as they could if he were in camp. In the morning, it would be easy enough to make sure that he wasn't following them. Kara finally understood Richard's intent and relaxed. He knew she would want any stranger in her sight while Richard and Kaelin were sleeping. Kaelin at his side, Richard started back to the wagon. The man followed, his head swiveling side to side from Tom to Kara and back again. Since they were headed back to the wagon, Richard finished what water remained in his waterskin, while behind, Owen thanked him for the invitation and promised not to be any trouble. Richard intended to see to it that Owen kept his promise. Chapter 10. Up in the wagon, Richard dunked Owen's two waterskins in the barrel that still had water. Owen, sitting with his back pressed against a wheel, glanced up at Richard from time to time, watching expectantly as Kara glared at him. Kara clearly didn't like the fellow, but as protective as Mord Sith were, that didn't necessarily mean that it was warranted. For some reason, though, Richard didn't care for the man either. It wasn't so much that he disliked him, just that he couldn't warm to the fellow. He was polite and certainly didn't look threatening, but there was something about the man's attitude that made Richard feel edgy. Tom and Friedrich broke up dried wood they'd collected, feeding it into the small fire. The wonderful aroma of pine pitch covered the smell of nearby horses. From time to time, Owen cast a fearful eye at Kara, Kaelin, Tom, and Friedrich. By far, though, he seemed most uneasy about Jensen. He tried to avert his eyes from her, tried not to look her directly in the eye, but his gaze kept being drawn to her red hair shining in the firelight. When Betty approached to investigate the stranger, Owen stopped breathing. Richard told Owen that the goat just wanted attention. Owen gingerly patted the top of Betty's head, as if the goat were a gar that might take off his arm if he weren't careful. Jensen, with a smile and ignoring the way he stared at her hair, offered Owen some of her dried meat. Owen just stared wide-eyed up at her, leaning down over him. "I'm not a witch," she said to Owen. "People think my red hair is a sign that I'm a witch. I'm not. I can assure you I have no magic." The edge in her voice surprised Richard, reminding him that there was iron under the feminine grace. Still wide-eyed, Owen said, "Of course not. I just never saw such beautiful hair before, that's all." "Why, thank you," Jensen said, her smile returning. She again offered him a piece of dried meat. "I'm sorry," Owen said in polite apology, "but I prefer not to eat meat, if it's all right with you." He quickly reached in his pocket, bringing out a cloth pouch holding dried biscuit. He forced a smile at Jensen as he held out the biscuits. "Would you like one of mine?"
Tom started, glaring at Owen.
Thanks, no,
Jensen said as she withdrew her extended hand and sat down on a low, flat rock. She snagged Betty by an ear and made her lie down at her feet.
You'd best eat the biscuits yourself if you don't want meat, she said to Owen. I'm afraid we don't have a lot that isn't.
Why don't you eat meat? Richard asked. Owen looked up over his shoulder at Richard in the wagon above him.
I don't like the thought of harming animals just to satisfy my want of food.
Jensen smiled politely.
That's a kind-hearted sentiment.
Owen twitched a smile before his gaze was drawn once again to her hair.
It's just the way I feel, he said, finally looking away from her.
Dark and Rawl felt the same way, Kara said, turning the glare on Jensen. I saw him horsewhip a woman to death because he caught her eating a sausage in the halls of the People's Palace. It struck him as disrespectful of his feelings. Jensen stared in astonishment.
Another time, Kara went on as she chewed a bite of sausage, I was with him when he came around a corner outside near the gardens. He spotted a cavalryman atop his horse eating a meat pie.
Dark and Rawl lashed out with a flash of conjured lightning, beheading the man's horse in an instant. Thump! It dropped into the hedge. The man managed to land on his feet as the rest of his horse crashed to the ground. Dark and Rawl reached out, drew the man's sword, and in a fit of anger slashed the belly of the horse open. Then he seized the soldier by the scruff of his neck and shoved his face into the horse's innards, screaming at him to eat. The man tried his best but ended up suffocated by the horse's warm viscera.
Owen covered his mouth as he closed his eyes.
Kara waved her sausage as if indicating Dark and Rawl standing before her. He turned to me, the fire gone out of him, and asked me how people could be so cruel as to eat meat.
Jensen, her mouth hanging open, asked,
What did you say?
Kara shrugged.
What could I say? I told him I don't know.
But why would people eat meat then, if he was like that?
Jensen asked.
Most of the time he wasn't. Vendors sold meat at the palace, and he usually paid it no mind. Sometimes he would shake his head in disgust or call them cruel, but usually he didn't even take notice of it.
Friedrich was nodding. That was the thing about the man. You never knew what he was going to do. He might smile at a person or have them tortured to death. You never knew.
Kara stared into the low flames of the fire before her.
There was no way to reason out how he would react to anything.
Her voice took on a quiet, haunted quality.
A lot of people simply decided that it was only a matter of time until he killed them too. And so they lived their lives as the condemned would, waiting for the axe to fall, taking no pleasure in life or the thought of their future.
Tom nodded his grim agreement with Kara's assessment of life in Dahara as he fed a crook of driftwood into the fire.
Is that what you did, Kara?
Jensen asked.
Kara looked up and scowled. I am Mord Sith. Mord Sith are always ready to embrace death. We do not wish to die old and toothless.
Owen, nibbling his dried biscuit, as if out of obligation to eat since the rest of them were, was clearly shaken by the story.
I can't imagine life with such savagery as all of you must live.
Was this Dark and Rawl related to you, Lord Rawl?
Owen suddenly seemed to think he might have made a mistake and rushed to amend his question.
He has the same name, so I thought, well, I just thought, but I didn't mean to imply that I thought you were like him.
Stepping down from the wagon, Richard handed Owen his full water skins. He was my father.
I didn't mean anything by the question. I would never intentionally cast aspersions on a man's father, especially a man who...
I killed him, Richard said. Richard didn't feel like elaborating. He recoiled from the very thought of going into the whole dreadful tale. Owen gaped around, as if he were a fawn surrounded by wolves.
He was a monster, Kara said, appearing to feel the need to rise to Richard's defense.
Now the people of Dahara have a chance to look forward to a future of living their lives as they wish.
Richard sat down beside Kaelin. At least they will if they can be free of the Imperial Order.
Head down, Owen nibbled on his biscuit as he watched the others.
When no one else spoke, Kaelin did.
Why don't you tell us your reasons for coming here, Owen?
Richard recognized her tone as that of the mother confessor asking a polite question meant to put a frightened petitioner at ease. He dipped his head respectfully.
Yes, mother confessor.
You know her too? Richard asked. Owen nodded.
Yes, Lord Rawl.
How? The man's gaze shifted from Richard to Kaelin and back again.
Word of you and the mother confessor is spread everywhere. Word of the way you freed the people of Alter Rang from the oppression of the Imperial Order is known far and wide. Those who want freedom know that you are the one who gives it.
Richard frowned. What do you mean, I'm the one who gives it?
Well, before, the Imperial Order ruled. They are brutal. Forgive me, they are misguided and don't know any better. That is why their rule is so brutal. Perhaps it isn't their fault. It is not for me to say.
Owen looked away as he tried to come up with words while apparently seeing his own visions of what the Imperial Order had done to convince him of their brutality.
Then you came and gave the people freedom, just as you did in Alter Rang.
Richard wiped a hand across his face. He needed to translate the book. He needed to find out what was behind the thing Kara had touched and the black-tipped races following them. He needed to get back to Victor and those who were engaged in the revolt against the Order. He was past due to meet Nikki, and he needed to deal with his headaches. At least, maybe Nikki could help with that much of it.
Owen, I don't give people freedom.
Yes, Lord Rawl.
Owen evidently took Richard's words as something he dared not argue with, but his eyes clearly said that he didn't believe it.
Owen, what do you mean when you say that you think I give people freedom?
Owen took a tiny bite of his biscuit as he glanced around at the others. He squirmed his shoulders in a self-conscious shrug. Finally, he cleared his throat.
Well, you do what the Imperial Order does. You kill people.
He waved his biscuit awkwardly, as if it were a sword, stabbing the air.
You kill those who enslave people, and then you give the people who were enslaved their freedom so that peace can return.
Richard took a deep breath. He wasn't sure if Owen meant it the way it came out, or if it was just that he was having difficulty explaining himself in front of people who made him nervous.
That's not exactly the way it is, Richard said.
But that's why you came down here. Everyone knows it. You came down here to the old world to give people freedom.
Elbows on his knees, Richard leaned forward, rubbing his palms together as he thought about how much he wanted to explain. He felt a wave of calmness when Kaelin draped a gentle, comforting hand over the back of his shoulder. He didn't want to go into the horror of how he had been taken prisoner and taken from Kaelin, thinking he would never see her again. Richard put the whole weight of emotion over that long ordeal aside and took another approach.
Owen, I'm from up in the New World.
Yes, I know, Owen said as he nodded.
And you came here to free people from...
No, that's not the truth of it. We lived in the New World. We were once at peace, apparently much like your people were. Emperor Jagang, their dreamwalker...
Yes, Emperor Jagang, the Dreamwalker, sent his armies to conquer the New World to enslave our people.
My people, too.
Richard nodded. I understand. I know what a horror that is. His soldiers are rampaging up through the New World, murdering and enslaving our people. Owen turned his watery gaze off into the darkness as he nodded.
My people, too.
We tried to fight back, Kaelin told him. But there are too many. Their army is far too vast for us to drive them out of our land.
Owen nibbled his biscuit again, not meeting her gaze.
My people are terrified of the men of the Order. May the Creator forgive their misguided ways.
May they scream in agony for all eternity in the darkest shadow of the Keeper of the Underworld,
Kara said in a merciless correction. Owen stared slack-jawed at such a curse spoken aloud.
We couldn't fight them like that, simply drive them back to the old world, Richard said, bringing Owen's gaze back to him as he went on with the story.
So I'm down here, in Jagang's homeland, helping people who hunger to be free to cast off the shackles of the Order. While he's away conquering our land, he has left his own homeland open to those who hunger for freedom. With Jagang and his armies away, that gives us a chance to strike at Jagang's soft underbelly, to do him meaningful harm.
I'm doing this because it's the only way we can fight back against the Imperial Order, our only means to succeed. If I weaken his foundation, his source of men and support,
then he will have to withdraw his army from our land and return south to defend his own. Tyranny cannot endure forever. By its very nature, it rots everything it rules, including itself. But that can take lifetimes. I'm trying to accelerate that process so that I and those I love can be free in our lifetimes, free to live our own lives. If enough people rise up against the Imperial Order's rule, it may even loosen Jigang's grip on power and bring him and the Order down. That's how I'm fighting him, how I'm trying to defeat him, how I'm trying to get him out of my land. Owen nodded. This is what we need, too. We are victims of fate. We need for you to come and get his men out of our land, and then to withdraw your sword, your ways from our people, so we may live in tranquility again. We need you to give us freedom. The driftwood popped, sending a glowing swirl of sparks skyward. Richard, hanging his head, tapped his fingertips together. He didn't think the man had heard a word he'd said. They needed rest. He needed to translate the book. They needed to get to where they were going. At least he didn't have a headache. Owen, I'm sorry, he finally said in a quiet voice. I can't help you in so direct a manner. But I would like you to understand that my cause is to your advantage, too, and that what I'm doing will also cause Jigang to eventually pull his troops out of your homeland as well, or at least weaken their presence so that you can throw them out yourselves. No, Owen said. His men will not leave my land until you come and... Owen winced. And destroy them. The very word, the implication, looked sickening to the man. Tomorrow, Richard said, no longer bothering to try to sound polite. We have to be on our way. You will have to be on your way as well. I wish you success in ridding your people of the Imperial Order. We cannot do such a thing, Owen protested. He sat up straighter. We are not savages. You and those like you, the unenlightened ones, it is up to you to do it and give us freedom. I am the only one who can bring you. You must come and do as your kind does. You must give our empire freedom. Richard rubbed his fingertips across the furrows of his brow. Kara started to rise. A look from Richard sat her back down. I gave you water, Richard said as he stood. I can't give you freedom. But you must double watch tonight, Richard said as he turned to Kara, cutting Owen off. Kara nodded once as her mouth twisted with a satisfied smile of iron determination. In the morning, Richard added, Owen will be on his way. Yes, she said, her blue-eyed glare sliding to Owen. He certainly will be. Chapter 11. What is it? Kaelin asked as she rode up beside the wagon. Richard looked to be furious about something. She saw then that he had the book in one hand. His other was a fist. He opened his mouth, about to speak, but when Jensen, up on the seat beside Tom, turned back to see what was going on, Richard said to her instead, Kaelin and I are going to check the road up ahead. Keep your eye on Betty so she doesn't jump out, will you, Jen? Jensen smiled at him and nodded. If Betty gives you any trouble, Tom said, just let me know and I'll take her to a lady I know and have some goat sausages made up. Jensen grinned at their private joke and gave Tom a good-natured elbow in his ribs. As Richard climbed over the side of the wagon and dropped to the ground, she snapped her fingers at the tail-wagging goat. Betty, you just stay there. Richard doesn't need you tagging along every single time. Betty, front hooves on the chafing rail, bleated as she looked up at Jensen, as if asking for her to reconsider. Down, Jensen said in admonishment. Lie down. Betty bleated and reluctantly hopped back down into the wagon bed. But she would settle for no less than a scratch behind the ears as consolation before she would lie down. Kaelin leaned over from her seat in the saddle and untied the reins to Richard's horse from the back of the wagon. He stepped into the stirrup and gracefully swung up in one fluid motion. She could see that he was agitated about something, but it made her heart sing just to look at him. He shifted his weight forward slightly, urging his horse ahead. Kaelin squeezed her legs to the side of her own horse to spur her into a canter to keep up with Richard. He rode out ahead, rounding several turns in the flatter land among the rough hillsides until he caught up with Kara and Friedrich, patrolling out in the lead. We're going to check out in front for a while, he told them. Why don't you fall back and check behind? Kalen knew that Richard was sending them to the back, because if he took Kalen to the back under the pretense of watching anything that might come up on them from behind, Kara would keep falling back to check on them. If they were out in front, Kara wouldn't worry about them dropping back and getting lost. Kara laid her reins over and turned back. Sweat stuck Kalen's shirt to her back as she leaned over her horse's withers, urging her ahead as Richard's horse sprang away. Despite the clumps of tall grass dotting the foothills and occasional sparse patches of woods, the heat was still with them. It cooled some at night now, but the days were hot, with the humidity increasing as the clouds built up against the wall of mountains to their right. Up close, the barrier of rugged mountains to the east was an intimidating sight. Sheer rock walls rose up below projecting plateaus, heaped to their very edge with loose rock, crumbled from yet higher plateaus and walls, as if the entire range was all gradually crumbling. With drops of thousands of feet at the fringe of overhanging shelves of rock, climbing such unstable scree would be impossible. If there were passes through the arid slopes, they were no doubt few and would prove difficult. But making it past those gray mountains of scorching rock, they could now see, was hardly the biggest problem. Those closer mountains spreading north and south in the burning heat at the edge of the desert partially hid what lay to the other side, a far more daunting range of snow-capped peaks rising up to completely block any passage east. Those imposing mountains were beyond the scale of any Kalen had ever seen. Not even the most rugged of the Rang Shaddaa Mountains in the Midlands were their match. These mountains were like a race of giants. Precipitous walls of rock soared thousands of feet straight up. Harrowing slopes rose unbroken by any pass or rift, and were so arduous that few trees could find a foothold. Lofty, snow-packed peaks that ascended majestically above windswept clouds were jammed so close together that it reminded her more of a knife's long, jagged edge than separate summits. The day before, when Kalen had seen Richard studying those imposing mountains, she had asked him if he thought there was any way across them. He had said no, that the only way he could see to get beyond was possibly the notch he'd spotted before, when he had found the place where the strange boundary had once been, and that notch still lay some distance north. For now, they skirted the dry side of the closer mountains as that range made its way north along the more easily traversed lowlands. Along the base of a gentle hill covered in clumps of brown grasses, Richard finally slowed his horse. He turned in his saddle, checking that the others were still coming, if a goodly distance behind. He pulled his horse close beside her. "I skipped ahead in the book." Kalen didn't like the sound of that. "When I asked you before why you didn't skip ahead, you said that it wasn't a wise thing to do." "I know, but I wasn't really getting anywhere, and we need answers." As their horses settled into a comfortable walk, Richard rubbed his shoulders. "After all that heat, I can't believe how cold it's getting."
"Cold? What are you..."
"You know those rare people like Jensen?" The leather of his saddle squeaked as he leaned toward her. "Ones born pristinely ungifted, without even that tiny spark of the gift? The pillars of creation? Well, back when this book was written, they weren't so rare."
"You mean it was more common for them to be born?"
"No. The ones who had been born began to grow up, get married, and have children. Ungifted children." Kalen looked over in surprise.
"The broken links in the chain of the gift that you were talking about before?"
Richard nodded. "They were children of the Lord Rahl. Back then, it wasn't like it has been in recent times with Darkin Rahl or his father. From what I can tell, all the children of the Lord Rahl and his wife were part of his family and treated as such, even though they were born with this problem. It seems that the wizards tried to help them, both the direct offspring and then their children and their children. They tried to cure them."
"Cure them? Cure them of what?"
Richard lifted his arms in a heated gesture of frustration.
"Of being born ungifted! Of being born without even that tiny spark of the gift like everyone else has. The wizards back then tried to restore the breaks in the link."
"How did they think they would be able to cure someone of not having even the spark of the gift?" Richard pressed his lips together as he thought of a way to explain it. "Well, you know the wizards who sent you across the boundary to find Zed?"
"Yes,"
Kalen said in a suspicious drawl. "They weren't born with the gift. Born wizards, that is. What were they, second or third wizards, something like that? You told me about them once." He snapped his fingers as it came to him.
Wizards of the Third Order, right?
Yes, just one, Giller, was the Second Order. None were able to pass the test to be a wizard of the First Order, like Zed, because they didn't have the gift. Being wizards was their calling, but they weren't gifted in the conventional sense. But they still had that spark of the gift that everyone has.
That's what I'm talking about, Richard said. They weren't born with the gift to be wizards, just the spark of it like everyone else. Yet Zed somehow trained them to be able to use magic, to be wizards, even though they weren't born that way, born with the gift to be wizards.
Richard, that was a lifetime of work.
I know, but the point is that Zed was able to help them to be wizards, at least wizards enough to pass his tests and conjure magic.
Yes, I suppose. When I was young, they taught me about the workings of magic in the Wizard's Keep, about those people and creatures in the Midlands with magic.
They may not have been born with the gift, but they had worked a lifetime to become wizards. They were wizards, she insisted.
Richard's mouth turned up with the kind of smile that told her that she had just framed the essence of his argument for him.
But they had not been born with that aspect, that attribute of the gift. He leaned toward her.
Zed, besides training them, must have used magic to help them become wizards, right?
Kaelin frowned at the thought.
I don't know. They never told me about their training to become wizards. That was never germane to their relationship with me or my training.
But Zed has additive magic, Richard pressed. Additive can change things, add to them, make them more than they are.
All right, Kaelin cautiously agreed.
What's the point?
The point is that Zed took people who weren't born with the gift to be wizards, and he trained them, but more importantly, he must have also used his power to help them along that path by altering how they were born. He had to have added to their gift to make them more than they were born to be.
Richard glanced over at her as his horse stepped around a small, scraggly pine.
He altered people with magic.
Kaelin let out a deep breath as she looked away from Richard and ahead at the gentle spread of grassy hills to either side of them, as she tried to fully grasp the concept of what he was saying.
I never considered that before, but all right, she finally said.
So what of it?
We thought that only the wizards of old could do such a thing, but apparently it's not a lost art, nor would it be entirely so far-fetched as I had imagined for the wizards back then to believe they could change what was into what they thought it ought to be. What I'm saying is that, like what Zed did to give people that with which they were not born, so too did the wizards of old try to give people born as pillars of creation a spark of the gift.
Kaelin felt a chill of realization. The implication was staggering. Not just the wizards of old, but Zed, too, had used magic to alter the very nature of people, the very nature of what they were, how they were born. She supposed that he had only helped them to achieve what was their greatest ambition in life, their calling, by enhancing what they had already been born with. He helped them to reach their full potential. But that was for men who had the innate potential. While the wizards of long ago probably had done similar things to help people, they had also sometimes used their power for less benevolent reasons.
So, he said, the wizards back then, who were experienced in altering people's abilities, thought that these people called the pillars of creation could be cured.
Cured of not having been born gifted, she said in a flat tone of incredulity.
Not exactly. They weren't trying to make them into wizards, but they thought they could at least be cured of not having that infinitesimal spark of the gift that simply enabled them to interact with magic.
Kaelin took a purging breath.
So, then what happened?
This book was written after the Great War had ended, after the barrier had been created and the old world had been sealed away. It was written after the new world was at peace, or at least after the barrier kept the old world contained.
But remember what we found out before?
That we think that during the war, Wizard Ricker and his team had done something to halt subtractive magic's ability to be passed on to the offspring of wizards?
Well, after the war, those born with the gift started becoming increasingly uncommon, and those who were being born without the subtractive side.
So after the war, she said, those who were born with the gift of both additive and subtractive were rapidly becoming non-existent. We already knew that.
Right.
Richard leaned over toward her and lifted the book.
But then,
when there are fewer wizards being born, all of a sudden the wizards additionally realize that they have all these pristinely ungifted breaks altogether in the link to magic on their hands. Suddenly, on top of the problems of the birth rate of those with the gift to be wizards dropping, they were faced with what they called pillars of creation. Kaelin swayed in the saddle as she thought about it, trying to imagine the situation at the keep at the time. I can see that they would have been pretty concerned. His voice lowered meaningfully. They were desperate. Kaelin laid her reins over, moving in behind Richard as his horse stepped around an ancient fallen tree that had been bleached silver from the sweltering sun. So I suppose, Kaelin asked as she walked her horse back up beside him, that the wizard started to do the same thing Zed did? Train those who had the calling, those who wished to be wizards, but had not been born with the gift? Yes, but back then, Richard said, they trained those with only additive to be able to use the subtractive too, like full wizards of the time. As time went on, though, even that was being lost to them, and they were only able to do what Zed did, train men to be wizards, but they could only wield additive magic. But that isn't really what the book is about, Richard said as he gestured dismissively. That was just a side point to record what they had attempted. They started out with confidence. They thought that these pillars of creation could be cured of being pristinely ungifted, much like wizards with only additive could be trained to use both sides of the magic, and those without the gift for wizardry could be made wizards able to use at least the additive side of it. The way he used his hands when he talked reminded her of the way Zed did when he became worked up. They tried to modify the very nature of how these people had been born. They tried to take people without any spark of the gift and alter them in a desperate attempt to give them the ability to interact with magic. They weren't just adding or enhancing. They were trying to create something out of nothing. Kaelin didn't like the sound of that. They knew that in those ancient times the wizards had great power, and they altered people with the gift, manipulated their gift to suit a specific purpose. They created weapons out of people. In the Great War, Jagang's ancestors were one such weapon, Dreamwalkers. Dreamwalkers were created to be able to take over the minds of people in the New World and control them. Out of desperation, the bond of the Lord Rahl was created to counter that weapon, to protect the people from the Dreamwalkers. Any number of human weapons were conjured from the gifted. Such changes were often profound, and they were irrevocable. At times, the creations were monsters of boundless cruelty. From this heritage, Jagang had been born. During that great war, one of the wizards who had been put on trial for treason refused to reveal what damage he had done. When even torture failed to gain the man's confession, the wizards conducting the trial turned to the talents of a wizard named Merit and ordered the creation of a confessor, Magda Siris. The first confessor extracted the man's confession. The tribunal was so pleased with the results of Wizard Merit's conjuring that they commanded that an order of confessors be created. Kaelin felt no different than other people felt. She was no less human, no less woman, loved life no less, but her confessor's power was the result of that conjuring. She, too, was a descendant of women altered to be weapons, in this case weapons designed to find the truth. "What's the matter?" Richard asked. She glanced over and saw the look of concern on his face. Kaelin forced a smile and shook her head that it was nothing. "So, what is it that you discovered by jumping ahead in the book?" Richard took a deep breath as he folded his hands over the pommel of the saddle. "Essentially, they were attempting to use color in order to help people born without eyes, to see." From Kaelin's understanding of magic and of history, this was fundamentally different from even the most malevolent experiments to alter people into weapons. Even in the most vile of these instances, they were attempting to take away some attribute of their humanity and at the same time add to or enhance an elemental ability. In none of it were they trying to create that which was not there at all. "In other words," Kaelin summed up, "they failed." Richard nodded. "So, here they were. The Great War was long over, and the Old World, those who had wanted to end magic, much like the Imperial Order, was safely sealed away beyond the barrier that had been created. Now they find out
that the birth rate of those carrying the gift of wizardry is plummeting, and that the magic engendered by the House of Rohl, the bond with his people designed to stop the Dreamwalkers from taking them, has an unexpected consequence. It also gives birth to the pristinely ungifted, who are an irreversible break in the lineage of magic.
They have two problems then, Kaelin said. They have fewer wizards being born to deal with problems of magic, and they have people being born with no link at all to the magic.
That's right. And the second problem was growing faster than the first. In the beginning, they thought they would find a solution, a cure. They didn't. Worse, as I explained before, those born of the pristinely ungifted like Jensen always bear children the same as they. In a few generations, the number of people without the link to the gift was growing faster than anyone ever expected.
Kaelin let out a deep breath.
Desperate indeed. It was becoming chaos.
She hooked a loose strand of her hair back.
What did they decide?
Richard regarded her with one of those looks that told her he was pretty disturbed by what he'd found.
They chose magic over people. They deemed that this attribute, magic, or those who possessed it, was more important than human life.
His voice rose.
Here they took the very thing they fought the war over, the right of those who were born the way they were, in that case people born with magic, to their own lives to exist, and they turned it all around to be that this attribute was more important than the life which held it.
He let out a breath and lowered his voice.
There were too many to execute, so they did the next best thing. They banished them.
Kaelin's eyebrows went up.
Banished them? To where?
Richard leaned toward her with fire in his eyes.
The old world.
What?
Richard shrugged, as if speaking on behalf of the wizards back then, mocking their reasoning. What else could they do? They could hardly execute them. They were friends and family, many of those normal people with the spark of the gift, but who were not gifted as wizards or sorceresses, and so didn't think of themselves as gifted, had sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, neighbors, who had married these pristinely ungifted, these pillars of creation. They were part of society, a society which was less and less populated by the truly gifted. In a society where they were increasingly outnumbered and mistrusted, the ruling gifted couldn't bring themselves to put all these tainted people to death.
You mean they even considered it?
Richard's eyes told her that they had, and what he thought of the notion. But in the end, they couldn't. At the same time, after trying everything, they now realized that they couldn't ever restore the link to magic once it was broken by these people. And such people were marrying and having children, and the children were marrying and having children, who in every case passed along this taint. And those so tainted were increasing in numbers faster than anyone had imagined.
As far as the gifted were concerned, their very world was threatened in much the same way it had been threatened by the war. That was, after all, what those in the old world had been trying to do, destroy magic. And here it was, the very thing they feared happening. They couldn't repair the damage, they couldn't stop it from spreading, and they couldn't put to death all those among them. At the same time, with the taint multiplying, they knew that they were running out of time, so they settled on what to them was the only way out, banishment.
And they could cross the barrier? She asked.
Those with the gift, for all practical purposes, were prevented from crossing the barrier. But for those who were pillars of creation, magic did not exist. They were unaffected by it, so to them the barrier was not an obstacle.
How could those in charge be sure they had all the pillars of creation? If any escaped, the banishment would fail to solve their problem.
Those with the gift, wizards and sorceresses, can somehow recognize those pristinely ungifted for what they are. Holes in the world, as Jensen said those like her were called. The gifted can see them, but not sense them with their gift. Apparently it wasn't a problem to know who the pillars of creation were.
Can you tell any difference? Kaelin asked. Can you sense Jensen as being different, being a hole in the world?
No, but I've not been taught to use my ability. How about you?
Kaelin shook her head.
I'm not a sorceress, so I guess that I don't have the ability to detect those like her.
She shifted her weight in her saddle.
So what happened with those people back then?
The people of the New World collected all those ungifted offspring of the House of Rohl
and their every single last descendant and sent the whole lot of them across the Great Barrier to the Old World, where the people had professed that they wanted mankind to be free of magic. Richard smiled with the irony, even of such a grim event as this. The wizards of the New World, in essence, gave their enemy in the Old World exactly what they professed to want, what they had been fighting for, mankind without magic. His smile withered. Can you imagine deciding that we had to banish Jensen and send her into some fearful unknown simply because of the fact that she can't see magic? Kaelin shook her head as she tried to envision such a time. What a horror! To be uprooted and sent away, especially to the enemy of your own people. Richard rode in silence for a time. Finally, he went on with the story. It was a terrifying event for those banished, but it was also traumatic almost beyond endurance to those who were left. Can you even imagine what it must have been like? All those friends and relatives suddenly ripped out of your life, your family. The disruption to trade and livelihood. Richard's words came with bitter finality. All because they decided some attribute was more important than human life. Just listening to the story, Kaelin felt as if she had been through an ordeal. She watched Richard riding beside her, staring off, lost in his own thoughts. Then what? She finally asked. Did they ever hear from those who were banished? He shook his head. No, nothing. They were now beyond the Great Barrier. They were gone. Kaelin stroked her horse's neck, just to feel the comfort of something alive. What did they do about those who were born after that? Still he stared off. Killed them. Kaelin swallowed in revulsion. I can't imagine how they could do that. They could tell, once the child was born, if it was ungifted. It was said to be easier then, before it was named. Kaelin couldn't find her voice for a moment. Still, she said in a weak voice, I can't imagine it. It's no different from what confessors did about the birth of male confessors. His words cut through her. She hated the memory of those times, hated the memory of a male child being born to a confessor, hated the memory of them being put to death by command of the mother. There was said to be no choice. Male confessors in the past had had no self-control over their power. They became monsters, started wars, caused unimaginable suffering. It was argued that there was no choice but to put a male child of a confessor to death before they were named. Kaelin couldn't force herself to look up into Richard's eyes. The witch woman, Shota, had foretold that she and Richard would conceive a male child. Neither Kaelin nor Richard would ever for an instant consider harming any child of theirs, a child resulting from their love for one another, from their love of life. She couldn't imagine putting a child of theirs to death for being born a male child of her as a confessor, or an ungifted male or female child of Richard for being a Rawl. How could anyone say that such a life had no right to exist because of who they were, what they were like, or what they might possibly become? Somewhere along the line after this book was written, Richard said in a quiet voice, things changed. When this book was written, the Lord Rawl of Dahara always married, and they knew when he produced an offspring. When the child was ungifted, they ended its life as mercifully as they could. At some point, ruling wizards of the House of Rawl became like Darken Rawl. They took any woman they wanted, whenever they wanted. The details, such as if an ungifted child born of those couplings was actually a pillar of creation, became unimportant to them. They simply killed any offspring except the gifted heir. But they were wizards. They could have told which ones were like that and at least not kill the rest. If they wanted, I suppose they could have, but like Darken Rawl, their only interest was in the single gifted heir. They simply killed the rest. So, such offspring hid for fear of their life, and one managed to escape the grasp of Darken Rawl until you killed him first. And so you have a sister, Jensen. Richard's smile returned. And so I do. Kaelin followed his gaze and saw distant specks, black-tipped races, watching, as they soared in the updrafts of the high cliffs of the mountains to the east. She took a purging breath of the hot, humid air. Richard,
those ungifted offspring that were banished to the old world, do you think they survived? If the wizards in the old world didn't slaughter them. But everyone down here in the old world is the same as in the new world. I fought against the soldiers from here with Zed and the Sisters of the Light. We used magic of every sort to try to halt the Order's advance. I can tell you firsthand that all those from the old world are affected by magic, so that means they are all born with that spark of the gift. There are no broken links in the chain of magic in the old world. From everything I've seen down here, I'd have to agree. Kaylin wiped sweat from her brow. It was running into her eyes. So what happened to those banished people? Richard gazed off toward the mountains beneath the races. I can't imagine. But it must have been horrifying for them. So you think that maybe that was the end of them? That maybe they perished or were put to death? He regarded her with a sidelong glance. I don't know. But what I'd like to know is why that place back there is named the same as they were called in this book, the Pillars of Creation. His eyes took on a menacing gleam. And far worse yet, I'd like to know why, as Jensen told us, a copy of this book is among Jagang's most prized possessions. That troublesome thought had been running through Kaylin's mind as well. She looked up at him from beneath a frown. Maybe you shouldn't have skipped ahead in your reading of the book, Lord Rawl. Richard's fleeting smile wasn't all she'd hoped for. I'll be relieved if that's the biggest mistake I've made lately. What do you mean? He raked his hair back. Is anything different about your confessor's power? Different? Almost involuntarily, his question caused her to draw back, to focus inwardly, to take stock of the force she always felt within herself. No, it feels the same as always. The power coiled in the core of her being did not need to be summoned when there was the need of it. As always, it was there at the ready. It only required that she release her restraint of it for it to be unleashed. There's something wrong with the sword, he said, catching her by surprise. Wrong with its power. Kaylin couldn't imagine what to make of such a notion. How can you tell? What's different? Richard idly stroked his thumbs along the reins, turned back over his fingers. It's hard to define exactly what's different. I'm just used to the feeling of it being at my beck and call. It responds when I need it. But for some reason it seems to be hesitant about doing so. Kaylin felt that now, more than ever, they needed to get back to Aedendrill and see Zed. Zed was the keeper of the sword. Even though they couldn't take the sword through the slough, Zed would be able to give them insight about any nuance of its power. He would know what to do. He would be able to help Richard with the headaches, too. And Kaylin knew that Richard needed help. She could see that he wasn't himself. His gray eyes held a glaze of pain, but there was something more etched in his expression, in the way he moved, the way he carried himself. The whole explanation of the book and what he had discovered seemed to have sapped his strength. She was beginning to think that it wasn't she, after all, who was the one running out of time, but that it was Richard. That thought, despite the warm afternoon sun, sent cold terror racing through her. Richard checked the others over his shoulder. Let's go back to the wagon. I need to get something warmer to put on. It's freezing today. Chapter 12. Zed peered up the deserted street. He could have sworn that he saw someone. Using his gift to search for any sign of life told him that there was no one anywhere around. Still, he remained motionless as he stared. The warm breeze pressed his simple robes against his bony frame and gently ruffled his disheveled white hair. A tattered, sun-faded blue dress that someone had pinned to a second-floor balcony railing to dry flapped like a flag in the wind. The dress, along with a city full of personal possessions, had long ago been left behind. The buildings, their walls painted various colors from a rusty red to yellow with shutters in bright contrasting hues, stuck out to slightly varying degrees on either side of the narrow cobbled street, making a canyon of colorful walls. Most of the second stories overhung the bottom floors by a few feet, and with their eaves hanging out even more, the buildings closed off the better part of the sky except for a snaking slit of afternoon sunlight that followed the sinuous course of the street up and over the gentle hill. The doors were all tightly shut, most of the windows shuttered. The pale green gate to an alleyway hung open,
squeaking as it swung to and fro in the breeze. Zed decided that must have been a trick of the light that he'd seen. Maybe a window pane that had moved in the wind, sending a flicker of light across a wall. When he was at last sure that he had been mistaken about seeing anyone, Zed started back down the street, yet remained close to one side, walking as quietly as possible. The Imperial Order Army had not returned to the city since Zed had unleashed the light web that had killed an enormous number of their force, but that didn't mean that there couldn't be dangers about. No doubt Emperor Jagang still wanted the city, and especially the keep, but he was no fool, and he knew that a few more light webs ignited among his army, no matter how vast it was, would in that instant reduce his force by such staggering numbers that it could alter the course of the war. Jagang had fought against the Midland and Daharan forces for a year, and in all those battles he had not lost as many men as he'd lost in that one blinding moment. He would not casually risk another such event. After such a blow, Jagang would want to capture the keep more than he had ever wanted it before. He would want Zed more than ever before. Had Zed more of the light webs like the one his frantic search through the keep had turned up, he would have already unleashed them all on the order. He sighed. If only he had more. Still, Jagang didn't know that he had no more such constructed spells. As long as Jagang feared that there were more, it served Jed's purpose in keeping the Imperial Order out of Adendrill and away from the Wizard's Keep. Some harm had been done to the Confessor's Palace when Jagang had been gulled into attacking. But Zed judged that trying that trick had been worth the regrettable damage. It had almost netted him and Addy the Emperor's hide. Damage could always be repaired. He vowed that it would be repaired. Zed clenched a fist at how close he had come to finishing Jagang that day. At least he had dealt a mighty blow to his army. And Zed might have had Jagang had it not been for that strange young woman. He shook his head at the memory of actually seeing one who could not be touched by magic. He'd known in theory of their existence, but had never before known it for certain to be true. Vague references in old books made for interesting abstract speculation, but seeing it with his own eyes was quite something else. It had been an unsettling sight. Addy had been shaken by the encounter even more than he. She was blind, yet, with the aid of the gift, could see better than he could. That day, she had not been able to see the young woman who was there, but in some ways, not there. To Zed's eyes, if not his gift, she was a beautiful sight, with some of Darkin Rawl's looks, but different and altogether captivating. That she was half-sister to Richard was clear. She shared some of his features, especially the eyes. If only Zed could have stopped her, kept her out of the way, convinced her that she was making a terrible mistake by being with the Order, or even if he could have killed her, Jagang would not have escaped justice. Still, Zed held no illusions about ending the threat of the Imperial Order simply by killing Jagang. Jagang was merely the brute who led other brutes in enforcing blind faith in the Order, a blind faith that embraced death as salvation from what it preached was the corrupt misery of life, a blind faith in which life itself had no value but as a bloody sacrifice upon the altar of altruism, a blind faith that blamed the failure of its own ideas on mankind for being wicked and for failing to offer sufficient sacrifice in an endless quest for some elusive greater good that grew ever more distant, a blind faith in an order that clung to power by feeding off the carcasses of the productive lives it ruined, a faith that by its very beliefs rejected reason and embraced the irrational, could not long endure without intimidation and force, without brutes like Jagang to enforce such faith. While Emperor Jagang was brutally effective, it was a mistake to think that if Jagang were to die that very day, it would end the threat of the Order. It was the Order's ideas that were so dangerous. The priests of the Order would find other brutes. The only real way to end the Order's reign of terror was to expose the naked evil of its teachings to the light of truth, and for those suffering under its doctrines to throw off the Order's yoke. Until then, they would have to fight the Imperial Order back as best they could, hoping at least to eventually contain them. Zed poked his head around a corner, watching, listening, sniffing the wind for any trace of anyone who might be lurking about.
The city was deserted, but on a number of occasions, stray Imperial Order soldiers had wandered in out of the mountains. After the destruction caused by the light web, panic had swept through the Order's encampment. Many soldiers had scattered to the hills. Once the army had regrouped, a large number of men had decided to desert instead of returning to their units. Tens of thousands of such deserters were rounded up and executed, their bodies left to rot as a warning of what happened to those who abandoned the cause of the greater glory of the Imperial Order, or as the Order liked to put it, the cause of the greater good. Most of the rest of the men who had run to the hills had then had a change of heart and straggled back into camp. There were still some, though, who had not wanted to go back and had not been caught. For a time after Jigang's army had moved on, they had wandered into the city, sometimes alone, sometimes in small groups, half-starved, to search for food and to loot. Zed had lost count of how many such men he had killed. He was reasonably sure that all of those stragglers were dead now. The Order was made up of men mostly from cities and towns. Such men weren't used to living in the wild. Their job was to overwhelm the enemy, to kill, rape, terrorize, and plunder. A whole corps of logistics personnel provided them with support, delivering and dispensing a constant stream of supplies that rolled into feed and care for the soldiers. They were violent men, but they were men who needed to be tended, who depended on the group for their survival. They didn't last long on their own in the trackless forested mountains surrounding Adendrill. But Zed hadn't seen any of them for quite some time. He was reasonably sure that the stragglers had starved, been killed, or had long ago headed back south to the old world. There was always the possibility, though, that Jigang had sent assassins to Adendrill. Some of those assassins could be Sisters of the Light, or worse, Sisters of the Dark. For that reason, Zed rarely left the safety of the keep, and when he did, he was cautious. Two, he hated poking around the city, seeing it so devoid of life. This had been his home for much of his life. He remembered the days when the keep was a hub of activity, not as it once had been, he knew, but alive with people of all sorts. He found himself smiling at the memory. His smile faded. Now the city was a joyless sight, forlorn without people filling the streets, people talking from one balcony to a neighbor across the street in another window, people gathering to trade goods in the market. Not so long ago, men would have stopped to have conversations in doorways, while vendors pulled carts of their wares along the narrow streets, and children at play skipped through the throngs. Zed sighed at the sad sight of such lifeless streets. At least those lives were safe, if a long way from home. Although he had many fundamental differences with the Sisters of the Light, he knew that their prelate, Verna, and the rest of the Free Sisters would watch over them. The only problem was that now the Jigang had nothing in Adendrill of any real value to conquer except the keep, and much to lose. He had wheeled his army east toward the remnants of the Midland forces. To be sure, the Dharan army waited across those mountains to the east, and Zed knew how formidable they were, but he couldn't fool himself that they stood a chance against a force as immense as the Imperial Order. Jigang had left the city in order to go after those Dharan forces. The Imperial Order could not win the war by occupying an empty city. They needed to crush any resistance once and for all, so that there would be no people left who could, by living prosperous, happy, peaceful lives, put the lie to the Order's teachings. Now that Jigang had come all the way up through the Midlands, he had cleaved the New World. Forces had been left all along the route to occupy cities and towns. Now the main force of the Order would turn its bloodlust east on a lone Dahara. By dividing the New World in such a way, Jigang would be able to more efficiently crush opposition. Zed knew that it wasn't for lack of trying that the New World had given ground. He and Kaelin, among a great many others, had worked themselves sick month after month trying to find a way to stop Jigang's forces. Zed clutched his robes at his throat at the painful memory of such arduous fighting, at how nothing had worked against Jigang's numbers, at the death and dying, at the friends he had lost. It was only a matter of time until all was lost to the hordes from the old world. Richard and Kaelin would not survive such a conquest by the Imperial Order. Zed's thin fingers covered his trembling lips at the ghastly thought of them being lost too. They were the only family he had left. They were everything to him.
Zed felt a crushing wave of hopelessness and had to sit on the stump of a log section set outside a shoe shop that had been boarded closed. Once the Imperial Order finally annihilated all opposition, Jigang would return to take the city and lay siege to the keep. Sooner or later, he would have it all. The future, as Zed imagined it, seemed to be a world shrouded in the gray pall of life under the Imperial Order. If the world fell under that pall, it would probably be a very long time before mankind ever emerged to live free again. Once liberty was surrendered to tyranny, it could be smothered for centuries before its flames again sprang to life and brightened the world. Zed hadn't sat for long when he forced himself to his feet. He was first wizard. He had been in hopeless straits before and had seen the foe turned back. There was still the possibility that he and Addy could find something in the keep that would aid them, or that they might yet discover information in the libraries that would give them a valuable advantage. As long as there was life, they could fight on toward their goal. They still had the ability to triumph. He harumphed to himself. He would triumph. Zed was glad that Addy wasn't with him to see him in such a sorry state that he would have, if even momentarily, considered defeat. Addy would have never let him hear the end of it, and deservedly so. He harumphed again. He was hardly inexperienced, hardly without the wherewithal to handle challenges that arose. And if there were assassins about, gifted or not, they would find themselves caught up by one of the many little surprises he had left around. Very nasty surprises. "Chin up," Zed smiled to himself as he turned down a narrow alley, making his way past a patchwork of yards with empty pens that had once held chickens, geese, ducks, and pigeons. His gaze passed over small back courtyards, their herbs and flowers growing untended, their wash lines empty, their wood and other materials stacked to the sides, waiting for people to return and work them into something useful. Along the way, he stopped in various vegetable gardens, harvesting the volunteer crops that had sprung up. There was lettuce aplenty, spinach, some small squash, green tomatoes, and still a few peas. He collected his bounty in a canvas sack and slung it over his shoulder as he walked the garden plots, checking on the progress of irregular patches of onions, beets, beans, and turnips. "Still some growing to do," he concluded. While the vegetables weren't thick from a careful planting, the random growth in yards all over the city meant that he and Addy would have fresh vegetables for some time to come. Maybe she might even take to putting some things up for next winter. They could store root crops in the colder places in the keep and preserve more perishable vegetables. They would have more food than they could eat. On his way up the alley, Zed spied a bush off toward the corner, sprawled green and lush over a short back fence between two homes. The blackberry bush was loaded with ripe berries. He paused occasionally to check up and down the streets beyond while he made a nice-sized pile of the dark, plump berries in a square of cloth, then tied it up and placed it atop the heavier goods in his sack. There were still plenty of ripe berries, and he hated to let them go to waste or to the birds, so he worked at filling his pockets. He didn't worry that it would spoil his dinner. It was a long walk back up the mountain to the wizard's keep, so he could use a snack. Addy was making a thick stew from cured ham. There was no danger that he would spoil his appetite on mere berries. She would be pleased by the vegetables he brought, and would no doubt want to add them to the stew straight away. Addy was a wonderful cook, although he dared not admit it to her, lest she get a big head. Before the stone bridge, Zed paused, gazing back down the wide road leading up the mountainside. Only the wind in the trees and their shimmering leaves created any sound or movement.